With Plan B, unfortunately, we had to skip a week, but she's had 2 weeks now to sharpen her wit. Rebecca Davis, good afternoon.
No pressure at all, John.
None.
I feel particularly dull.
Oh, do you?
Yes, indeed.
Okay, I'm duller than you are, so there we go. We'll see how dull we can collectively be.
A race to the bottom. I look forward to it.
A gestalt of dullness, that is what we are going to be over the next few minutes. I was really interested in the article that you wrote earlier this week about these two new reports that look at electoral form, because we're dealing with a situation where the Constitutional Court has said to government that by the next general election, which is scheduled for 2024, you must reform the country's electoral laws so that independence can stand.
That's right. And in taking advantage of kind of this moment, I think, in the air is this general spirit that now is the chance to reform our electoral system. And I didn't actually realize, John, that this was something that was kind of preempted by the drafters of the Constitution, who basically said, look, this is the system we're using to push us over the line at the moment. But please, please do review it. Do review it kind of ASAP. So now we're having these, I think what it'll be a kind of flurry of suggestions of how we can reform the electoral system. And honestly, John, some of it is very difficult. It's complicated stuff because it's, you know, it's revolved around proportions and figures in a way that can be very complex. But I'm interested in the ways people are thinking about how we can incorporate this thing that independents have to be allowed to stand for office. And you and I have discussed this before kind of facetiously. But now we're getting into the nitty-gritties of how it'll work. So in the report put together by Rolf Meyer and his expert panel, for instance, they say that they don't want to make it that individuals running for office should have to put down a financial deposit, because that will inevitably rule out you know, some people for economic reasons. So they say instead you have to be seconded, basically. So you have to be seconded or seconded by a threshold number. So sort of signatures or whatever, people expressing support for you and your run for office. And they say that the minimum amount would be about probably 3,000 votes, 3,000 people saying, yep, I think John Mason could be the person I will vote for.
Okay.
3,000 votes, that seems like quite a lot. It's you know, to go out and find 3,000 people willing to say, I will vote for you.
How many votes do political parties need under the proportional system to get a seat in Parliament? I mean, obviously, it depends how many people vote, but the ceiling's around about 30,000, isn't it?
I think it's about 50,000.
50,000.
Yeah, it's somewhere around there, 30,000 to 50,000 votes. So, yeah, understood, it's not as much as that, and it's a way around the financial threshold, which is massive, obviously, at the moment. It's hundreds of thousands, isn't it? It's quite a lot if you. Yeah. Anyway, the point is, who would have that amount of people ready and willing to second them? And I was chatting to UCT politics professor Anthony Butler, whose work I love, and I'm constantly trying to get him to comment on things. And he made a very good point to me, and quite a chilling one, I think, which is that one of the categories of people who will definitely be able to rustle up 3,000 people to vote for them are church leaders. And we actually already saw this in the last general election, where there was this kind of flurry of smaller parties suddenly getting registered before the elections, run by pastors, preachers, church figures. None of them did particularly well, but there's definitely already a precedent that there are religious figures in this country who have the appetite for political office. So when we're looking at individuals, independents, who have an existing constituency, well, I think Professor Butler is right. I think that that would be an area that church leaders might definitely leap into. And we know, unfortunately, that some of these are actually not the most savory individuals at all. In fact, a lot of them are very dubious fly-by-night characters. So there is that concern. And the other concern that he raised, which I also have to kind of endorse, is that in a situation where individuals are looking to kind of rile up passions to the point where people want to follow them into the National Assembly, what are you going to use? Well, you're going to use kind of negative stuff. You might use xenophobia. You might use racism. You're going to appeal basically to people's basic instincts, because how else are you going to make a kind of name for yourself as an independent? And you don't have to follow a national party's political platform. How great. You can make your own doctrine. Unfortunately, it might be a negative one.
Is there any sense from these two reports how many votes it might take for an individual to get into a provincial parliament or a national parliament? I mean, if it's 50,000 to get a seat in the National Assembly as a political party, is there any kind of breakdown of those figures that says John Matham, you know, asks his listeners, will 3,000 of you please sign this digital petition saying that you think I'd make a decent MP? How many votes would I have to get in order to go and sit on the those in that august chamber?
So you would, I mean, this is where it does get complicated.
Yeah, okay.
You would be representing a constituency, and this constituency would be voted for by between about 270 and 624,000 voters. But they would each constituency would be voting for 3 to 7 representatives. So if we break that down, we're still looking at a high number of votes, John, maybe even more than 50,000, somewhere around, I think, 70 or 80,000 as a minimum threshold. So it seems, you know, when you think about the logistics of how an independent is going to get voted in, wow, that seems like a high bar. Unless, as I said, you have an existing following.
And I'm very glad that we're talking about this next story, because Nicola has been trying to get hold of Professor John Woolhouse, I think his name is, one of the scientists. Mark Woolhouse, who's quoted in a Guardian article saying it's absolutely ridiculous for the beaches to have been closed.
Yeah, and this is something that hurt me a bit, John, I must say. It kind of it saddened me a bit, because I was one of the people who was happy that the beaches were closed and who said everyone should calm down and that, you know, we should just toughen up about the beaches being closed. It seemed sensible to me that we just want to stop people gathering in large quantities basically anywhere. But as I say, John, the thing about being someone who professes to believe in science and facts is that we have to be willing to change our opinions when the facts suggest that we are wrong. And in this case, it seems I definitely am wrong. So Professor Mark Woolhouse, this Edinburgh epidemiologist, telling British MPs last week there were no outbreaks, this is in the UK last summer, linked to public beaches, despite the fact that there were these scenes of people on several days, like descending en masse to Bournemouth and a couple of other places. He said there's never been a COVID-19 outbreak linked to a beach ever, anywhere in the world, to the best of my knowledge. And that the same kind of audience in the House of Commons, the MPs were also told that only about 10% of COVID-19 transmission happens outdoors, and that generally involves a mixture of indoor and outdoor time, and also generally involves prolonged close contact anyway. So the message is very much that, you know, the UK is now going into the second summer, we're coming out of summer, but in general, governments looking to crack down in future could do better than restricting outdoor time. That outdoor time, in fact, really is one of the safest ways to allow people to socialize during COVID-19, and that the alternative, forcing them indoors, is infinitely worse. So beaches should be open.
I mean, I wouldn't go to a beach which is as full as Musingburg Beach or Camps Bay Beach or some of the other beaches are on certain days of the year when the weather is fine, because then there's a very good chance that I would be in prolonged contact with other people, even accepting the science that 10% of COVID transmissions happen outdoors, 90% indoors. There are certain occasions on the beach where I wouldn't go there. And that's always been my view, that it was reasonable and rational to stop those days in the parts of the country where there are vast traverses to the beach. Stop that. And for the rest, you know, let people go.
I think that's right, because one thing I haven't mentioned is that what those figures don't take into account, and which they still say is a definite threat, is, for instance, how are people getting to the beaches, right? So they're using perhaps crowded public transport, and that absolutely does still present the same risks. So I think you're right. A measured approach would close the beaches on those days when everyone descends on them using kind of mass transport, etc. But for the rest of them, in fact, people should be encouraged to get outside.
And then the relationship between the complexity of one's brain and one's extreme views, particularly conservative extreme views. I know you're going to enjoy this one.
Just the Schadenfreude, John. So extremists are dummies, and I'm so sorry to have to tell everyone this. But if you have a friend who is like really into QAnon, then frankly, you should feel very sorry for them, because the evidence is now out that they literally are not able to pass evidence in the same way as people with higher functioning IQ. And if this just sounds like me being nasty, it's not. It is science. The researchers from Cambridge gave American participants, I'm so glad they were American too, obviously the best place to carry out this research. They gave American participants a battery of tests over 2 weeks, but tests designed to be neutral, like memorizing visual shapes. And what they were testing was participants' ability to engage in complex and strategic mental processing. And they found that people with extremist attitudes struggle with complex tasks requiring intricate mental steps. First do this, then do this, then do this. But what really got me, John, was this bit, that people who are stuck in their ways, people who are resistant to evidence. So you know your friend who believes in QAnon and will not accept anything to the contrary. These people actually have a perceptual problem processing evidence. So in these tests, for instance, they would say, which way are these dots moving? Are they moving to the left or the right? And these people would take much longer to be able to answer that, and sometimes answer incorrectly. So people, the other finding was that people with tendencies towards extremism are not good at regulating their emotions. They're impulsive and they seek out emotionally intense experiences, which could also be why we're seeing these very extreme forms of protest, why we saw the, you know, the storming of the Capitol, where we saw some of those masked speech protests in South Africa, so extreme, because they are seeking out intense emotional experiences. But there we have it, John. It's from science. Extremists are just a bit less sharp upstairs.
Thank you very much, Rebecca Davis.